Welcome, everybody, to Review Away. It's John Pollock and Wei Ting.
You don't look too happy, John. Why?
What's I'm wrong? Not happy at all, Wei, because we just finished doing a 90-minute Review Away podcast, and we did not hit record.
Well,
I did not hit record. I used we because I thought we were a team, but apparently when we fuck up, it's you and I.
It's happened before. We were on a really good streak, actually.
No fuck-ups for like 6 months since that Unforgiven travesty.
Well, we had to redo it three times.
And that was at least computer problems. We had hit record, and then there were, problems with the audio skipping in and out, right?
I don't even care. This was completely
human error on my part. I'm extremely pissed, and Wei, to your credit, you just kind of like chuckled and were like, okay, we'll have to do it again.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've been through it, you know.
You're a very laid-back individual.
It happens, and what can you do? Okay, We're human.
I hate redoing things, so I hope this show is okay, everybody.
It'll be even better.
I hope so. So we're going to get into things right away.
I actually don't feel... great.
Well, I'm sorry if I brought you down. You were kind of all up for doing this the second time, and I was the one that was down. So let's try and get through this, because TNA Bound for Glory, Wei.
I'm just thinking of like the person listening to this like for the first time, maybe thinking, what the fuck?
These guys are losers, and I do not want to listen to the rest of this podcast. They have just told me it's going to be terrible. It's not going to be terrible, folks, because we always bring life. I just had a coffee here, so that's a solid start to a podcast.
We're just going to role play here and pretend that this is the first time we're recording. So all our reactions will be completely genuine, even though we've given the exact same reactions just maybe an hour ago.
Yeah. Bound for Glory, quickly, everybody. It took place on Sunday, October the 23rd, 2005, and two nights prior was the Fight Network's launch party at the Cool House nightclub in downtown Toronto, and it featured members of the TNA crew coming up to Toronto for some matches. So we actually got to be around some of the TNA crew as they were heading into this big pay-per-view. Mm-hmm. And, Wei, you had a bit of an interaction with Jeff Jarrett and Samoa Joe.
Well, I was just starting out with the Fight Network at the time, and I think the day of that party, I was one of the people who was just greeting some of the guests that showed up. We had Chuck Liddell show up. We had Larry Holmes, Bret Hart.
And Carl DeMarco was there.
Right. And then a number of TNA wrestlers arrived to wrestle a match. Amongst the roster were Samoa Joe and Jeff Jarrett, who I welcomed into the building. And I remember just being very excited even back then. That week, actually, for this just Samoa Joe versus Jushin Thunder Liger match that we're about to see on this pay-per-view. And I even asked Joe, are you excited about wrestling Liger? And then Joe just said, yeah, we'll see. And then Joe started singing or humming the Jushin Liger theme song.
And did you identify the song?
Absolutely.
That's awesome.
I have the song.
That was like his little test to see how much of a fan you were.
Yeah. Well, he's just kind of doing it off into the distance. He wasn't really...
You guys didn't go into a duet or anything like that?
No, we're not friends.
Oh, that's too bad. It was this was really, I would say, the peak of Samoa Joe's popularity. He was just coming off of that match with Kenta Kobashi for Ring of Honor at the Manhattan Center. He also, the month prior, had this awesome three-way match with AJ and Daniels at the Unbreakable pay-per-view, which, to my in my belief, the best match in TNA history.
Wow.
And in fact... a little-known tidbit that around 2007, TNA, actually, they were putting out a collectible card set, and it featured all the performers, and then they had things called TNA Moments, and they actually contacted me to write a card.
Really?
So they asked, we're not going to ask you what event to cover, we just want to know your favorite TNA moment and why. And send it in, and you're going to have a collectible trading card made with your name on it.
That is cool.
So I sent it in to them, and I picked that Unbreakable thing. And I didn't write it like kayfabe. I wrote that I wrote about the match quickly. I only had it was like a tweet, pretty much. It was like 140 characters.
Had to fit on a trading card. Yeah,
it was like 250 characters or something. And I wrote how on this night, it was a major milestone for TNA because the X Division performers prove that not only can they steal the show, but they can also close the show.
Huh.
And then one day I got this gigantic poster with all the cards in this thing, including mine.
Really?
And I have it somewhere. I think it's on my parents'
house. Does it say your name on it?
Yeah.
I had no idea.
They put a John Pollock on there. So I'm on a TNA trading card because of that match.
That is amazing. Yep. John Pollock's trading card from TNA Wrestling.
I will try and I'll try and find it, actually, and I will scan it for the Facebook group. But
yeah,
give me a few weeks because I have no idea where this poster is.
That's really cool, man. It's a real collector's item out there.
That story was not included in our first podcast go around. Yeah. So you see, I'm trying to add upon different,
or maybe it was
stories. Was it? You'll never know. Mm-hmm. You would know. All right, let's get into Bound for Glory, everybody. It took place in Orlando, Florida, at the Impact Zone. Our announcers are Mike Tenay and Don West. I was a fan of Don West, Way, but you not as much.
I didn't like Don West at all. I mean, this guy had just come from what's that shop. That infomercial channel.
Yeah, he was doing those late night ads.
And I understand why they might have hired him. I'm sure he's an asset for their website for whatever, for selling their merchandise. But as a commentator, my big complaint about Don West is that he only has one speed, and that is
fifth gear.
Yeah, just hyper, just nonstop high energy. And so for some of these matches, sure, it works well, but I can't listen to a man talk that way for 3 hours. It's not. First of all, it doesn't seem genuine. It's like you're seeing an actor just act as hyper as he can for 3 hours, and it really got on my nerves. And you know what? I'm not saying I love Mike Tenay too, but even Tenay and West together, like Tenay himself, didn't really. I never got a sense of a flow of a real match. They had to just keep going on and on without any breaks in between, which is my big complaint.
Jim Ross has talked about that in the past, about how as an announcer he would have different gears to go towards, and he would know when to switch from 1 to 2, 2 to 3,
exactly,
and so on to build and heighten a match.
Yeah.
Jim Ross was never screaming throughout a match. It was always to really, really sell something
as
monumental. I was more... I didn't find Don West to be fake. I found his enthusiasm did sound natural. To me, he sounded more like a fan that was just really excited to be here. Whereas the current commentary crew, I find Taz more often than not, it's almost a sarcastic tone he puts on the broadcast, where it's like he's letting us in on this joke that we're watching. And it's like, I am playing an announcer and ha-ha. And I'm not a big fan of that style of commentary. I would take Don West over Taz, but that's my opinion. This event was started off where they promoted it as a 3.5 hour pay-per-view event where the first 30 minutes are free. So a kind of clever way of saying we have a pre-show. And this, the first 30 minutes, it featured a four-way match way with Alex Shelley, Roderick Strong, Austin Aries, and Sanjay Dutt. And I thought this was a solid match to put on to the preview show because it was a really, really hot opener, and it really got across the action aspect, the alternative nature of TNA, if you were on the fence about buying this pay-per-view.
Yeah, really. This was, to me, like the very meaning of total nonstop action, and it was showcasing the X Division. They pretty much brought in three ROH guys, three guys that comprise the stable known as Generation Next from Ring of Honor, in there in Strong, Aries, and Shelley against Dutt. And I thought this was actually a really smart crowd in the TNA Impact Zone who knew all these guys and started even chanting Austin Aries at one point. And just a beautiful Dragon Rana from Sanjay Dutt for the victory at the end.
Yeah, this was just a really, really fast-paced match. I thought Sanjay Dutt just worked and continues to work a really strong babyface style. He is best suited for that. I found when he moved over and became a heel, he was still working like a babyface, mm-hmm. but was supposed to be a heel, and it didn't work. But in this, Dutt just looked great in this match. And as you mentioned, getting the win with the Dragon Rana. Hot 10-minute match, and to me, that's the kind of match you put on a pre-show. Everyone talked about for the WEC earlier this year with Leonard Garcia and Chan Sung Jung. It's this fantastic fight that I'm sure added a lot of people buying at the last minute. And in pro wrestling, you had the advantage of knowing ahead of time how good a match could potentially be. Mm-hmm. It's not like a fight where sometimes there's a lot of variables to having a great fight. With a wrestling show, you do have that advantage, and they used it to their maximum here by putting these four out. You knew the kind of match you'd get.
And this was, like, no mistake about it, this was a spot fest. There was no psychology, really, in any of these spots. It was just seeing what these guys could do. But for a countdown show, is probably the thing that you really wanted.
Shane Douglas is then in the locker room with America's Most Wanted. Shane Douglas at this point in time was the backstage interviewer for NWA TNA. And they replay the angle from the night before when Impact was airing on Saturday nights, where AMW used a beer bottle on the Naturals to win the tag titles, and the rematch will be taking place tonight. Mm-hmm. Kind of backwards there. Title change leads into the pay-per-view match.
I don't know why. I don't know why they did that.
Then Raven comes out to cut a promo on Larry Zbysko, who at this point was the commissioner of TNA. And Raven states that he wouldn't trade this moment, quote, for God's balls and a nutcracker. And he's upset over losing his NWA title in September at a Border City Wrestling show in Windsor, Ontario. And he blames Zbysko and Canada for the fact he does not have the championship anymore. And is playing up this conspiracy that TNA management has against him that they are playing up through Larry Zbysko. Zbysko then comes out and tells Raven essentially to fuck off. And they get into this brawl with security involved. And then Rhino comes out and he says that the Raven of 5 years ago would have killed all of these men. And that the Raven of 5 years ago crucified a man and took a man's family hostage. And thus, he doesn't deserve a title shot right now because he abides by the law. And all I could think of, Wei, was that if I was a Catholic, I'd be a little offended by this segment here on the pre-show. I might not be between God's balls and crucifixion angles being cited here.
You are a Catholic.
I am. I thought of that halfway through. I forgot. But, well, maybe if I was a more serious Catholic, I'd be more offended by this and not want to give these blasphemous promoters my $30.
Yeah, it's a good way of. It's always been a good way of drawing heat.
Religion.
Bring in religion.
Cassidy Riley was out there. He's the protege of Raven and was dressed up as Raven and took a gore from Rhino. Then we go backstage and Shane Douglas is with AJ Styles discussing his Iron Man match for later tonight against Christopher Daniels for the championship. And the preview show ends with Jushin Thunder Liger showing backstage walking towards the entranceway. And I thought that was a good way to end the show. I mean, Jushin Liger has a really cool presence to him, and just the fact that he was there and you were going to be starting off the show with that, especially for the hardcore audience, that was a good little hook right at the last shot of the pre-show.
How many people, though, do you think
know who Liger is?
Well, no, I mean, do you think we'll wait till the very last minute to decide whether or not to buy a show?
I would assume that the majority would have decided by that point if they were ordering it or not, but you never know. I mean, people could have fully sat down just saying, hey, we're just going to watch a half hour of this and then we'll move on. Like, and maybe last ditch effort is like, all right, the pre-show's ending and this is what's about to happen and I'm going to miss it.
Really? Because, like, to me, I guess the way I've always seen it and heard about it was just if someone is deciding to buy a show, they would have already decided maybe the week of before, not 30 minutes leading into a show.
I would assume most. I've never been in a position where I've tuned into a pre-show not planning to order a pay-per-view. So I don't know what how much business that a pre-show generates. You don't typically see WWE doing pre-shows anymore before their pay-per-views. I'm sure there's a certain reason for that. So we go into the pay-per-view, and it starts off with a very epic video discussing TNA's rise and their struggle. And they used a James Earl Jones voice guy with this man who was wearing something that resembled a dashiki.
I believe it's called a boo-boo.
A boo-boo. You actually looked this up.
Yeah, B-O-U-B-O-U. Look it up. It's exactly what this man is wearing. I don't know if this is the actual voice guy.
Or if it was dubbed over.
Yeah, or if it was just a mime.
It's hard to tell.
But basically a man wearing a boo-boo, speaking in that deep, this is TNA voice.
Now, when you went online to look up what this was, what did you search?
I searched African traditional dress.
Oh, okay. And the James Earl Jones voice guy, he kind of incorporates all of the pay-per-view names into TNA's struggle to make it here to Bound for Glory, and it just got, after like 8 pay-per-view titles.
Well, give us an example.
It was like, TNA has been against all odds, but in our unbreakable struggle, we have shown no surrender. And he just kept going on and on with like every single pay-per-view. And now we are Bound for Glory. Just very... David Sahadi loves the over-the-top, this is the beginning of life style of promo for a pay-per-view. It's like you have ordered the keys to evolution with this pay-per-view.
He's very cheesy. But you know what? For like what is supposedly the WrestleMania of the year, I thought it was somewhat appropriate. You're rounding up all the year's events.
The match, the show kicks off with Samoa Joe against Jushin Thunder Liger. Joe comes out with these Polynesian dancers and does this this dance with them. And some people might not be aware, but when Joe was younger, his whole family toured around doing these styles of dances at different fairs and other shows. So this actually did have a connection to Joe's upbringing. But a lot of people complained about this entrance because Joe was presented as this killer, this monster at the time. Mm-hmm. And here you're having him do this goofy dance, and it didn't really fit with his character, some thought. But I didn't really mind it. It was...
I didn't mind it either, especially considering what he's doing these days.
I know, this is really a drop in the bucket.
Yeah, but I think I understand that criticism too, because you have Samoa Joe here who didn't really showcase any personality aside from beating people up in the ring.
And now it was almost like if Bill Goldberg had come out and suddenly was doing some Jewish traditional dance.
Yeah.
I mean, the fact is, he is Jewish, but it doesn't work with him. Why is that different? Why is that funny?
It's exactly
it's the same deal.
It's a great, great analogy. It's actually a perfect comparison, and I just laugh at that idea of seeing Bill Goldberg come in with a what do you call the things on the side
with
of
a
the head?
Like, I don't know. He was like singing like about dreidels, maybe,
yeah.
Something.
Okay.
I don't want to insult anybody. That's not our intention here. We're just trying to make an example.
Well, what do you call those things, though?
A yarmulke?
No, the things you put on this, like the little curly hair things.
Their hair?
No. I apologize.
I'm not gonna guess what it's called because I'm gonna offend all of our Jewish listeners, and I want to move on.
Especially those living in Israel.
Yes, and we do have listeners in Israel. So shy. You can maybe send us the answer while we awkwardly move on from this.
Maybe we should just step outside of the booth and ask.
We were not prejudiced during the first round of this podcast, but we have delved into that here.
Let's redo this again.
Nope, we are not. Liger is met with red and white streamers from the crowd. They show Simon Inoki at ringside. Mike Tenay seems so happy here about this. He was just excited.
Oh, yeah, he is. He's the historian. He's the professor.
Don West notes, what an entrance by Samoa Joe, showing a little personality. We had no real solid babyface or a heel in this kind of a match. They booked Joe as just the big monster.
Yeah, this was actually really just a dream match.
Yeah, it was.
Between two, especially to the hardcores, two very big names.
We saw Joe kick out of a top rope splash. Joe then went for a muscle buster, but Liger countered with a powerbomb for a two count. Liger then had two open palm thrusts by... to Joe's chest, then went to the top rope, and he took a kick and a muscle buster from Joe, who then applied a rear naked choke. The referee raised Liger's arm 3 times, and Joe gets the clean victory. I thought really solid booking for TNA, Joe going over Liger clean. The criticism is, I'm sure a lot of people, especially in the wake of the Kobashi match, this was just a 7-minute opening match, and was not booked to steal the show in any way.
Yeah, it was from TNA's standpoint, and I guess they just wanted a hot opener. They wanted Joe to go over, and to me, as a hardcore fan, I thought it was too short, and it just felt like they were getting started, but I understand why it was kept that way.
They show highlights from the Fan Fest over the weekend for Bound for Glory, featuring one fan who states he's flown down to Orlando 8 times this year to see TNA pay-per-views. That's a dedicated follower. Then they go ringside and they show us John Bolin and Jamie D, who were the gut check winners for TNA, essentially getting developmental contracts for their non-existent developmental company. And we would see Jamie D the next year come in briefly as Serelda, the manager for AJ Styles and Christopher Daniels, mm-hmm. if you can believe that. And now she calls into shows that Trish Stratus appears on.
Does she?
Yeah, remember she called into the surf?
She did?
Yeah.
What about John Boland?
Don't know what happened to John Boland, but they had some hopes for him, and I don't think he ever made it to television.
Okay.
Simon Diamond is then shown backstage. He's yelling at his fellow Diamonds in the Rough members, Elix Skipper and David Young, about how important their next match is. It's a six-man tag with Diamond, Young, and Skipper taking on Apollo, Sonny Siaki, and Shark Boy. And I noted, is this really a match that belongs on the biggest show of the year, this throwaway six-man? This seemed like this was one of the things I didn't like about TNA. All their pay-per-views, they felt the need to get everyone on the roster on these shows. And it's like, you don't have to get everyone on the pay-per-view. I know it's nice that they get a payday, but part of pay-per-views being special is that this features the best of the best talent on this show, not just everyone's got a spot.
I agree. I completely agree. Not just with pay-per-views, but even a lot of independent shows that we've been to, shows that are like 4 or 5 hours long.
Yeah, where everyone's got to get their shit in.
Too much.
Skipper attacks the knee of Apollo early on, which didn't really matter because he didn't sell it. Apollo hit an F5 on his bad knee to Young. Then we see a spot where Skipper ran on top of the back of David Young and then went over top Apollo, and he took out Sonny Siaki, which looked impressive. Young then goes off of the middle rope to the floor, taking out the guys that were on the floor, and then Apollo hits a somersault over the top of the floor. Finish comes when Skipper thrusts Siaki up in the air into a spinebuster by David Young, and they get the win. So just a very average 6-minute match, and the heels get the victory in this match. Did not belong on the pay-per-view. Shane Douglas is with Jeff Jarrett and Gail Kim backstage, and Jarrett says that Kevin Nash went to great lengths to get out of an ass-whooping. We forgot to mention this off the top. They did mention it on the pre-show, that Kevin Nash had to dial 911 and is in the hospital and will not be able to be in the main event tonight. He was scheduled to challenge Jeff Jarrett for the NWA title, and this actually made this pay-per-view stronger because if you looked on paper, that looked to be the weakest match on the show.
Yeah, was this a legitimate reason?
See, a lot of people were skeptical here because there were a number of times during Nash's TNA run where he was scheduled to lose on pay-per-view and a mystery illness or injury prevented him from appearing on the pay-per-view. It would happen the next year with Chris Sabin. So I think people were naturally skeptical because I believe Jarrett was booked to go over in that match. And so I'll give the guy the benefit of the doubt. Apparently he was in a hospital. But yeah.
Thank goodness.
Thank goodness that he was in the hospital?
Yeah.
Horrible person. So Jarrett suggested to Zabisco that he just pick a name out of a hat. And he goes name by name saying, screw this guy, screw this guy. And then Way's favorite ex-NFL player, Monty Brown, walks in. And he dares Jarrett to say that about him. And Brown states that he smells fear.
This guy, Monty Brown, I completely forgot about his existence until this cutting a promo that just makes it seem like he just learned about alliteration in his second grade English class. He says his opponent tonight will be tumultuously taken care of, perpetually popped, and he'll be pounced, period.
Marquise Corvan, he's like WWE fans.
He just comes in with this delivery, too, that's just I guess it's his gimmick where he's supposed to talk like an animal about whatever the Serengeti and all that shit, and it's just, he's like a clown. He's like a guy trying to act like a dog. He just comes in as if a dog could talk.
Mike Tenay announces that tonight's pay-per-view is dedicated to the memory of the Crusher, Reggie Lazowski, who passed away the night before. A big, big AWA star and big legend in Milwaukee. And then we go to our next match. It's Lance Hoyt and Monty Brown. They show a sign that says, Alpha Male, more like Beta Female. These zingers from this audience.
It's there because they're opposites.
Yeah. Hoyt is now performing in the WWE as Vance Archer, which you might want to look up for confirmation. Looks exactly like Test here. Mm-hmm. And he also had a tramp stamp.
Oh, really?
Yeah. These wings coming out of his waist.
Why would a guy ever get one of those?
They look horrible. Brown was selling well for Hoyt early on. Hoyt then went for a moonsault, but he was pushed to the floor. Dueling chance for both guys. Brown sets up the pounce, but takes a big boot, and then Hoyt hits a moonsault onto Brown for another two count. Then Hoyt kicks out of the alpha bomb. Brown kicks out of the choke slam. So they're kicking out of each other's finish here. They trade big punches back and forth, and then Brown finally hits the pounce for the victory. I thought they did a bit too much. The crowd was into it. There was this big following for Lance Hoyt at this time. You could even see in the front row, these guys had black and white shirts that said Hoytomania on it in the Hulk Hogan font. And the big story at the time was that Hoyt would always go to the local bar after the show and buy shots for the fans and stuff like that.
Really?
So it was somewhat manufactured reaction would for Lance
really,
Hoyt.
Really?
Oh, yeah. He'd go and drink with the fans and stuff like that afterwards. Okay.
Well, it made him look great on TV, so well worth it. If that's all it takes to get your audience into it, then every company should be doing it.
Yeah. They show highlights of a recent media tour of India featuring Sanjay Dutt, Simon Diamond, and some others. And then Shane Douglas is with Conan, BG James, and Ron Killings, who are collectively known as Three Live Crew. And Kip James walks in, stating that for their six-man tag with Team Canada tonight, he says he'll have their back, and BG and Killings think this is a great idea to have this guy help them, and Conan says no, it's a terrible idea, and Kip James walks off stating, I offered.
Yeah.
The drama ensues. Is Kip James helping them or hurting them?
Yeah, I have nothing, you just go on. I have nothing to say about this portion. I mean, even back 5 years ago, I didn't care to see Kip James and BG James reunite.
And that is what they were building for months and months. Our next match, it's the six-man, Three Live Crew taking on Team Canada. Bobby Roode, Eric Young, and A1, the wrestler, not the steak sauce. All the guys were bumping for Conan earlier in the match, and then Conan grabs his shoe. He throws it at Eric Young, who takes a bump over the top rope via a shoe. Mm-hmm. Kip James comes out. He's sitting at ringside with a very clever T-shirt. Way
says, "I'm Kip James, bitch."
Very clever. Truth makes the hot tag to BG. BG attempts a pump handle slam on Eric Young, but Roode comes in and hits BG with a hockey stick, and then Young pins James. And then Kip comes down to the ringside area. He pulls BG out of the ring so that Team Canada cannot attack him. Then he enters the ring with a chair, and he teases hitting Conan, but instead he takes out A1 with the chair, and the rest of Team Canada bails. And this plays into the tease that Kip James is actually a babyface trying to help Three Live Crew.
You know what I realized while watching this match? I actually enjoyed R-Truth. I enjoyed his in-ring work. I really thought he was very mobile and had some spectacular offense.
It was crunk.
Yeah.
Shane Douglas is backstage ambushing Larry Zbyszko on who will be facing Jeff Jarrett. And Zbyszko says he is waiting for a call and someone will get a shot tonight. And delivered this wearing his flame button-up shirt. Then next way we got the Ultimate X match. It's Petey Williams, Matt Bentley, and Chris Sabin. Bentley comes out with Tracy Brooks, and all of his mannerisms are like the same as Shawn Michaels, his cousin. And I guess you could pick worse people to emulate than Shawn Michaels. This was a pretty strong match. Early on, we see Sabin be the first to try and climb across, but Bentley slaps him in the back and then hits an atomic drop off of the top rope to a hanging Chris Sabin. There was a spot where Williams is distracted by Tracy, and Tracy pulls Williams' face into her chest. And this allows Bentley to climb across, but Williams gets away in time. He is knocked down by Sabin, and then Sabin grabs Bentley from the legs, and Bentley delivers an elbow drop to Williams on the ground. Sabin hit this very cool-looking tornado DDT in the middle of the ring to Williams, and he kicks Bentley in midair. Looked just like a great spot. Williams hit a top rope hurricanrana onto Bentley on the floor. Then they ran into some problems, where Sabin was climbing across the ropes, and Bentley speared him from the ropes, and the X that was in the middle that they were trying to grab falls down to the ring right in the middle, and the crowd immediately boos. Williams tries to play heel here, trying to grab it, but the officials won't let him grab it. And I thought Mike Tenay and Don West did a very good job of just playing this off and working it into the match.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, not only the announcers, but I thought the workers did well with it too. I mean, it would have been dumb to just ignore something like that. But for a guy like Williams to pretend as if this was a real match, why wouldn't he go and just grab it? He's the bad guy.
Then the officials come in the ring with a ladder, and they hang the X back up to let the match continue. And then they got back into the ring. Bentley and Saban are climbing across the ropes. They fight right in the middle, and they both fall down, and Williams is standing there, and the X falls again, and it falls right into the hands of Williams, and they ended the match and declared Williams the winner. I knew the guys were really upset after this because they probably had a ton of stuff laid out that they had to cancel because the match was kind of ended without anyone's knowledge, and they Williams was the winner. I thought it came off fine. You had the heel winning in a heel manner where he just kind of lucked into this victory, and they ended up doing this match on television about 11 days later, and they and Williams went over in that match as well, and I think that match was designed to do the spots they couldn't get in on the pay-per-view.
Definitely could have been a lot worse.
Yeah.
They managed to save it very well with having the heel right underneath to catch it. Could have been a lot worse.
They did get lucky in some points with Williams just being the guy to go over, getting it in that fashion. I thought that was the finish was fine.
But,
and had they hung it a second time, I think it would have got a little like, okay, this match is falling apart.
For sure.
The second time was a good just call it there.
For sure.
That was a good call on their part. Despite the fans' chance of bullshit. Then we get a recap of the AMW Naturals program. Jared and AMW are all aligned together here as a group along with Gail Kim, with Jarrett holding the NWA title, AMW having the tag titles, and they show the angle where they took out Team 3D, who had just debuted in TNA, and then they held a funeral segment on Impact for Team 3D, which was very entertaining at the time. So then we get AMW versus the Naturals, a rematch for the tag titles from the night before. They brawled all over the arena to start the match. Harris is thrown into the ringside barricade, and a fan leans over the barricade and just squeezes the foot of Chris Harris.
Squeezes foot?
It's very odd, but that was
creepy.
Yes. It's all Naturals getting the heat on AMW to start the match.
Why are they called the Naturals?
Maybe it means they're just Naturals at this industry.
Are they naturally big? Naturally built?
Maybe that could be it as well. Mm. I think it's meant to mean just an ability, like, you're a natural at this. Okay. Like Randy Couture.
Yeah, okay.
Perhaps. I don't know.
Sure. I never liked that nickname. Nature Boy. Natural. It just sounds like a hippie name. you're into nature.
I guess. Well, the Nature Boy. That, to me, I always thought of trees when I first heard about the Nature Boy Ric Flair when I was a kid.
The environmentalist.
Yes, the green wrestler. He's a green wrestler. Flair would not be the best example for that.
No.
But anyway, the match continues. Gail Kim distracts Andy Douglas, and Storm is able to attack Douglas and make a comeback there. Andy Douglas is bleeding after AMW double teams him. Then we see a spot where James Storm has a powder. He throws it at one of the Naturals, who ducks, and he hits Harris in the face. And then Harris hits Storm with the catatonic, thinking it's one of the Naturals. And then the Naturals hit the AMW's finish on them, the death sentence, for a two count. Douglas goes after Gail Kim on the floor, and Harris just comes up from behind him and handcuffs Douglas to the guardrail, apparently unblinded now. Douglas looked like a total tool here, getting handcuffed to the guardrail. And then Storms hits Chase Stevens with a beer bottle while Rudy Charles is distracted by Gail Kim. They hit the death sentence on Chase Stevens, and James Storm gets the pin. They retain the tag titles. Don't know why you did the title changes the night before when you were going to be having AMW go over Sunday night at the pay-per-view.
I don't know either. I mean, there must be a good reason, though.
I don't know what it was. Then there's a video preview for Monsters Ball 2 with the storyline that all four have been forced to fast and locked in solitary confinement for the past 24 hours before this match.
That's the story. And do they... I would have liked to have seen them drive this point home, perhaps showing some footage of these men trapped inside their cell without any food and water. Because to me, when for instance, when Rhino comes out, when these guys come up, they look very fresh to me. Rhino, having been sequestered for 24 hours without food, water, or shelter, He comes out all greased up from, like, baby oil.
Why would you want to put them in solitary confinement before a match?
To make... Okay, here's the definition for the Monsters Ball. The key premise of the match was that all contenders are sequestered alone in a locked room without light, food, or water for 24 hours before the match. This stipulation is intended to induce extreme feelings of aggression in the competitors. Once released, the wrestlers fight one another in a no-disqualification match with the usage of weapons encouraged.
So well, if they explained it, then all the power to them. Yeah, that's great.
That is to induce extreme feelings of aggression.
Extreme feelings of aggression. So we get Monsters Ball 2 before the matchup. Father James Mitchell cuts a promo with Abyss posing in the background. Great promo from Mitchell. I was always a big fan of his promo and especially his work in TNA. Even he did some great stuff in ECW, but I found TNA, he really came along as a solid, solid promo in the business. And the match, it's Rhino, Jeff Hardy, Sabu, and Abyss, Monsters Ball 2. Sabu's right eye is bloody just seconds into this match. All four fought into the audience. Hardy brought in a garbage can full of sticks and garbage. The crowd was really behind Sabu early on. And we see Hardy hit Abyss off of the back of Sabu with a poetry in motion. And then Hardy gets onto all fours and offers his back to Sabu, who runs across the ring and rather than jump off Hardy, kicks Hardy right in the ribs. I love that spot.
Mm-hmm, because Van Damme and Sabu originated that poetry in motion spot.
Then we saw a choke slam to Rhino by Abyss onto a chair. That got a two count. Then we got double tables being set up as Sabu set up a table that was wedged between the apron and the barricade that he ended up jumping off of a chair and putting Rhino through the table. Then at the entranceway, Abyss was setting up tables, and this led to Jeff Hardy knocking down Hardy onto the... Hardy knocked Abyss onto the tables. Then he climbed up the entrance area, like the staging area, high above the tables, and then delivered a swanton, clearing the ramp and going on to Abyss.
For comparison's sake, the height that Hardy jumped from would have been maybe the equivalent of perhaps like the middle of the Titantron, for instance. Like if he scaled the Titantron and then climbed to the middle portion of it, he dove from that height, that distance, onto Abyss through two tables below the deck in that little area that they usually put the jib and exploding electrical boxes.
Yes. So not only was Hardy trying to get height, but also distance here because he had to clear the stage to make this. He landed it just about as perfectly as you could here. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing that I do not ever recall this spot. Like, it's never been replayed, really, and it was just this phenomenal-looking spot, and it's kind of just been forgotten.
Yeah, like, I'm just thinking of Jeff Hardy alone during his WWF run. Anytime they talk about, you know, don't try this at home or any sort of highlight package, you always either see his jump from that huge ladder in TLC 2, or you see one of his swanton dives from like a WrestleMania through the table. Those images are always stuck in your head. This, to me, of any Jeff Hardy spot, this was just as impressive, if not...
the most dangerous, I think, I would say, because...
And Grace
could have easily missed and, like, hit the staging area or something. Yeah. And
his swanton here was just very graceful. Like, I think amongst all those spots, this one looked, to me, the best. But you never even see it.
It's a phenomenal spot. And it didn't even lead to the finish, amazingly. We go back into the ring. Sabu hit a triple jump moonsault onto Rhino for a two count. Then Abyss is back in the ring, recovering from that table spot. That should have taken Abyss out of the entire match. Should have probably taken both guys out.
Yeah.
Abyss brings Tax into the ring. He turns around before he can open the Tax and takes a gore through a table by Rhino. And Hardy is in the ring at this point. Rhino delivers a pile driver to Hardy off of the second rope and gets the pinfall. But as he's pinning him, Sabu runs in to break up the fall. And I think he was too quick on trying to break up the fall because it looked like he actually did break up the fall. They rule Rhino as the winner. Fans were tremendously into this match. And if you're a fan of these matches, they're an extremely dangerous style. It's not always my cup of tea, but if you are... this was just about as well done a match of this style as you're going to get.
And obviously, over the past few years, everybody in the wrestling community has become more heightened to the dangers of some of these matches, especially, you know, looking at all these, a lot of these chair spots that ended up being completely meaningless in the end. But back in 2005, this was a very good hardcore match, and by any standards, they definitely delivered what they said they were going to do.
Yeah, this set the standard very, very high for these matches in the future, whether that be positive or negative. Then we go to Larry Zbysko backstage, and he announces that tonight there will be a 10-man gauntlet over the top rope battle royal, and the winner will get an immediate NWA title shot against Jarrett. And Jarrett asks if this is Zbysko's decision or TNA management's decision. And this didn't make any sense, because earlier in the night, Jarrett had told Zbysko, just pick a name, pick anyone, it doesn't matter, I'm better than them. And in this instance, Zbysko is putting together a gauntlet match where theoretically whoever wins this will have been worn out from winning this match, and Jarrett just comes out to for the remaining pieces of this guy. It's actually an easier match for Jarrett because this guy will have gone through a match and Jarrett's fresh. So it didn't really make sense for Jarrett to suddenly be upset here at this decision made by Zbysko. We then get a video preview for the next match. It's AJ Styles versus Christopher Daniels in a 30-minute Iron Man match for the X Division Championship. At this point, Daniels wore this goofy neck collar during his matches.
It was like a Catholic priest collar.
With no shirt on.
With no shirt, so he looked just like a male stripper.
Yes. Very basic offense going back and forth to start this match. They didn't get into any high spots right away. The first big maneuver happened actually outside the ring where Daniels was in the crowd. The referee sent AJ back to the ring. AJ walked away and then ran at Daniels, jumped over the steel steps, over the barricade, and onto Daniels, which is the first real big spot. And then they went back into the ring. They slowed things down with Styles delivering a long headlock spot that Daniels eventually escaped.
They were long headlocks, but they always managed, like, they always worked in teases of Daniels breaking out of them.
Yeah, they kept them very active, and it was
like it
wasn't just a rest spot.
Yeah, it sounds like something so basic and typical, but I never really got the sense that these two were just there resting. Whereas, you know, like, if just remember a classic examples of rest holds gone horribly wrong, like that Buff Bagwell Booker T match from the first WCW show with that chin lock of death, basically, that just stayed where the two of them just stay there forever. This, for example, you know, you would have AJ put Daniels in a headlock, but they would get up every so often and bounce the ropes once, have AJ grab Daniels back into a headlock again, but all with like done with like real aggression.
Yeah, like an actual fight.
Yeah,
that was mixed in with like these big impressive moves on top of it.
So they're still able to get their win back, but just done so in a more convincing fashion.
Yeah. A lot of stuff in this match. Some highlights included both guys exchanging holds and then Daniels locking in the Koji clutch. I love that submission. It looks really, really good. And AJ was able to power up and reach the ropes to break out of that. We saw a springboard flip off of the middle ropes by Styles into an inverted DDT on Daniels. Then Styles hit a springboard, but Daniels countered with a Death Valley driver. Styles ran into a spinning powerbomb by Daniels for a near fall. Daniels came back with the best moonsault ever. We were 21 minutes into the match when Daniels hit this suicide dive to the floor that looked fantastic. And take us through the finishing sequences here, Way, as they got into the last couple of minutes.
Yeah, we're just a couple minutes down and still no pinfalls, tons and tons of near falls. By this time, the crowd was pretty lively, cheering behind both men equally, chanting their names. And just consider the fact that this was already 3 hours into the show and that the crowd was this hot.
They went to all of this.
It was pretty cool. Now, the finishing sequence comes when Daniels goes for the Angel's Wings, but it's reversed into a bridging pin attempt from AJ. Daniels powers out of that. Then AJ trips him over with a double leg takedown for another pin, but Daniels struggles out of that, but right into a position for Styles to lift him up into a Styles Clash with 10 seconds to go. Now, like, the remaining actions here were done so with, like, a real sense of struggle from AJ and Daniels. So, like, as he's getting him up for the Styles Clash with 10 seconds to go, he was going really slow to the effect of, you know, you don't know if this guy has enough energy or you don't know if they're going to go to a draw if they're going to have enough time for the pinfall. But with 10 seconds remaining, AJ lifts Daniels up into the Styles Clash. hits it, and then with 6 seconds to go, slowly, slowly rolls him over and then pins Daniels for the three count with 2 seconds remaining.
They nailed this finish. It was awesome. Yeah. It was so well done. Mm-hmm. So many times you'll see guys who they have to hit a specific like second to make this work, and it's a lot of times gets botched. These guys were just excellent in hitting this finish. The story was really well told in this match, and these guys were just phenomenal athletes. This might have been the best Styles Daniels match I've seen between these two, easily match of the night and match of the year candidate.
Yeah, and just think about the pace that these two guys were going at for 30 minutes. Their cardio must be tremendous.
It was, you know, and they have that handicap of the fans knowing that they're going 30 minutes. You know you're in for a 30-minute match here, which can be difficult at times.
But it didn't seem slow.
Not at all. This 30 minutes, I was totally captivated by this entire match. It was just so well done. And this, to me, exemplified the alternative that TNA was at this time. And these were the guys people wanted to get behind and follow. Mm. It was just tremendous match. Styles was in tears after the match. It was just a really, really well done match.
Yes.
We then go into the 10-man gauntlet match to determine the number one contender for the NWA title. The deal was two people would start, and then after 2 minutes, the third entrant would come in, and then it was every minute thereafter.
Like a Royal Rumble.
Exactly. We start off with Samoa Joe and Ron Killings, and Killings makes fun of Joe's Polynesian dancing from earlier in the night, and Joe punches him in the face. Sabu was the third one out, who came with a chair, and he threw the chair at both men right in the face. Lance Hoyt was the fourth one out, and he was followed up by Abyss, who came out selling his hand. It wasn't the most intimidating presence for this monster heel.
He was just in the monster's ball.
He was probably hungry, too, and he had to come out and wrestle again. And then this cool spot occurs where Abyss gets into the ring and has a stare down with Samoa Joe, and the crowd totally pops for this.
Yeah.
It was two guys that had been well protected in TNA, and it was a fresh match that people were definitely clamoring for.
Two guys that they built up themselves, didn't pay for from the WWF.
It's like these guys are over and well-known because of TNA.
Yeah.
Not because we're popping, because that's the guy who once headlined WrestleMania.
It's not Angle versus Hardy versus Mr. Kennedy.
Yeah.
It's two guys that they brought up themselves, and the crowd was way behind them.
For sure. Jeff Hardy was the sixth guy out. He comes out limping, followed by Monty Brown, who hits Sabu with the pounce immediately. Brown then eliminated Hardy and himself. And we were noting earlier when we were doing this how Jeff Hardy, granted, his biggest run with WWE was his second run where he became the WWE champion, but he came in as a big star in the TNA, and on this card, he was just another guy on the card. He was probably maybe fifth most over guy, if that.
It
was
behind like, Samoa Joe.
Behind Joe, behind Styles. Yeah. I mean, they were into these stars that TNA had created. I wouldn't say they would be, you know, stars that would sell hundreds of thousands of pay-per-views, but they were on to a real cool path at this point with the guys they were focusing on.
Yeah.
Then we had Rhino come out, who clotheslined Hoyt over the top rope. Ninth entrant was Kip James, who hadn't even worked on this show, and I didn't think really belonged in this match. And the 10th and final entrant was AJ Styles. Just amazing that they sent this guy out to work again following that 30-minute match.
Mm.
And had to have been in legitimate pain. They bring up how Larry Zbysko didn't put Raven into this match to further that storyline with the conflict. Don West notes, for AJ to win, this would require a Herculean strength that men just don't possess. And then Sabu was eliminated at some point during this that the commentators missed, and so did I. Abyss tossed Kip over the top rope, and he falls off the apron as he pushes Ron Killings back into the ring to keep Killings in the ring to show that Kip was more concerned with Ron Killings than his own NWA title shot.
Yeah. He literally sacrificed himself to help the three live crew.
Compelling. Very, very compelling. Then Joe and Styles go back and forth, and Joe locks in the rear naked choke, and then Abyss dumps both of them over the top rope with the submission still applied to Styles. It's down to Rhino and Abyss, and Rhino hits Abyss with the gore and then tosses him over the top rope. So Rhino immediately gets an NWA title match with Jeff Jarrett, who comes out. Tito Ortiz is the special guest referee here, Way, who would be who was wearing his referee shirt with punishmentathletics.com written on the back of his referee shirt.
He's a businessman.
Oh, yeah, he is.
Absolutely.
Businessman at the core. Jarrett brings out a casket because he promised that tonight someone was going to be put in the casket. Rhino is bleeding from the forehead right away.
I guess it's playing up on the whole 3D funeral bit.
Everyone's got a gimmick. He puts guys in caskets.
Caskets.
It's weird in wrestling. It's very, very weird. Jarrett gets the heat on the floor, attacking Rhino for what seemed like ages. Ortiz looked like a traffic cop who was just waving his arms, saying, "Get back in the ring! Get back in the ring!" Twice, Jarrett hits Rhino from the top rope, and the third time, Rhino makes a comeback and hits a reverse atomic drop, which Wes notes is right in the nuts. And then Gail Kim comes out to the ring to distract. She jumps off the top rope for a crossbody, and Ortiz catches her and drops her to the floor. Jarrett grabs his guitar. He swings and misses. Rhino goes for the gore, but he is hit with the guitar as he comes in for the gore. Only gets a two count, does Jarrett. And the kick out, I thought, would get a bigger pop than it actually did. AMW is out to ringside with another guitar. They get punched out by Tito Ortiz. And then Rhino goes for Jarrett, who is holding the guitar, hits the gore, and Rhino gets the win. This was about 6 minutes. Very, very basic match. Just Jarrett getting the heat on Rhino. Rhino makes his comeback, and Ortiz gets his spots where he knocks out AMW and dumps Kim out of the ring. So Rhino is your new NWA champion, but then AMW, basically no-selling the Ortiz punches, runs in, attacks Rhino, and then Team Canada comes out, bringing out the casket into the ring. They're all attacking Rhino. They put him into the casket, and Jarrett is posing on top of the casket with the title he just lost. The lights go out. Team 3D returns after their beatdown angle a few weeks ago, and they attack everybody. They deliver a 3D to Eric Young, throw him into the casket, and they go off the air with like Team 3D as the big stars, and Rhino is almost just an afterthought here who just won the NWA title, and he would hold that title for a monumental reign of 11 days before Jeff Jarrett beat him for the title again. So it looked like Jarrett was booked to go over Nash here, and they felt that we're not giving you Nash in the main event, so we'll give you a title change.
What is the logic behind that, though, putting Jarrett over Nash on supposedly their WrestleMania, having the top heel?
Hey, I'm not complaining that they weren't going to put the title on Nash if that was your top babyface.
No, but just which kind of perplexes me as to why they would even suggest that match.
The way this was booked at the end, I have no doubt the ending was the same way it was booked, where Jarrett would have won the match. He's posing with Nash as kind of just the afterthought, and then Team 3D gets all the heat at the end for the big return.
Okay, well,
I'm certain that's how it was originally booked.
Did you
enjoy the review the second time?
Sure, yeah. It was
okay. What did you give this show? I gave it a 7.5 out of 10, but having to review it twice, I do give it a 7 out of 10. I lowered half a point.
I give it a 7 out of 10 as well. For me, the storylines, I wasn't following the show at the time, and just even listening back to it, I didn't really care for it too much. But in ring, a very strong show. Not only do you have great matches up and down the card, but you had a great variety of matches from different styles of professional wrestling. If you wanted a great tag team match, you had that. If you wanted a good cruiserweight spot fest, you had that. If you wanted a scaffold type of Ultimate X match, there's that. There's a slower Iron Man match and a good hardcore match as well. And even a battle royal, so they pretty much loaded this show with matches. There's a lot of filler that they could have cut out, but all in all, good in-ring action on the show.
Quick note before we go to feedback is that in 2005, TNA's pay-per-views were just so solid, and they were doing significantly better buys in 2005 than in 2010. And you consider the level of names they now have in TNA, that's insane. And for those people who say, well, you guys are just, you know, the internet fans would love Styles and Daniels, but it's not viable on a bigger picture. And the fact was, at this point, they had a time slot Saturday nights at 11 p.m., and they were doing .9s every week. Today, they're doing a 1-1, a 1-2 on Thursday nights, and they're doing like one-fourth of the pay-per-view buys they were doing in 2005, where you were focusing on guys like Styles, Daniels, Joe. And today, you have much bigger names, but you're doing a fraction of the business on pay-per-view and television. to me, it's like you've jumped 0.2, 0.3, and you're Thursday nights in prime time. So, you know, for those people that this product was connecting with people much better. It wasn't just something where it was like the hardcores were loving this. I mean, they were still doing 30, 35,000 buys, which isn't setting the world on fire. Yeah. But it makes you think, had they followed with that path, where would they have grown over the years?
For me, I'm always more interested in seeing new compared to old, because it just seems like they're doing something.
This didn't feel like 1997 transformed into 2010.
Exactly.
This felt like 2005 at 2005.
It would feel like I'm watching something cool and hip, something that's the future. And that makes me feel like I'm on the cutting edge of professional wrestling, rather than watching a company try to play catch up by hiring all the rejects from the WWF.
Yeah, and I understand your issue with like Kip and BG. It was like that's an example of more going back to stuff, but it was like they were in such a nothing mid card angle that it almost didn't bother me as much. Whereas it just seems that right now the focus is on who was working in 97 rather than why was that stuff working in 97? Because it was similar. 97, 98, WWF, WCW, that did feel innovative. It felt new at that time. Mm-hmm. That stuff doesn't feel new 13 years later. Just because it worked then, the time period had a huge part in that working at that time, mm-hmm. where the Attitude Era did connect with people.
Yeah,
it's not the same thing anymore. Just like if you were to look at something that connects now, it's not going to work 10 years from now. Anyway, that's our thought of the day. Let's get into this feedback way. I wonder what everyone has to say. Sam Kennerly, I cannot listen to that Melanie Pillman interview ever again. If I ever see Vince McMahon, I'm going to punch him in the fucking face. I'm still angry about this 13 years later. Erg. Mm.
Jeff Johnson, if I remember correctly, Pillman was supposed to have two matches on the Bad Blood card, and that's why they had two thrown together matches. One match with Dude Love and the other with Goldust. Maybe I'm wrong. Neither Dude Love or Goldust ended up being on the card at all.
Jay Lambeer, listening to the podcast right now, and you guys were talking about Undertaker holding his own head. Originally, Undertaker was called Kane the Undertaker before he had his Survivor Series debut, so maybe he was breaking away from himself. Undertaker's power separated and manifested Kane, his brother. LOL. Yeah, I don't know about this one. I think that's giving WWF too much credit for what was a bad poster.
Yeah. They just they wanted an interesting visual.
Yes.
Matt Cruz, the Jericho DVD is the best DVD that the Fed has put out in a long time. I just wish they would have went into him punching HBK's wife in the face at SummerSlam. Also, the matches were great, but I wish they would have put his match with Christian from WrestleMania 20 on it. Have you guys ever thought of possibly reviewing old indie shows like UWA from Mississauga?
Yeah, UWA, we used to air on the Fight Network for a bit. It's just, I find it's more entertaining to review shows that are more than just straight matches, and you can chat about other elements, and also have a bigger spectrum and a bigger audience.
Yeah, I mean,
UWA, it's like, it's a very small audience that had any chance to see those shows.
Yeah, we can talk about it, but how many people would have heard about Rip Impact? Or Joey
Christopher
Slick.
Bishop.
Chris Bishop, exactly.
Maybe we can put our award-winning documentary online for people.
Maybe we'll review that one.
Yeah. Well, next up is Cesar Solano. Hey, guys, I enjoy catching the show each week. It gives me a little something extra to look forward to each week. I just wanted to mention that sometimes my brother hears these podcasts while I'm listening to them, and although he doesn't really care about the wrestling portion, he actually loves the Jersey Shore reviews you guys do right after. He is hooked now, especially the wrestling lingo you guys incorporate into it. Just goes to show you that it's possible to gain a small following of ex-wrestling fans or fans who don't even watch the product at all with these reviews. I personally find the Jersey Shore reviews more entertaining than the actual show. Well, thank you, Caesar. We appreciate the positive feedback.
Thanks. Alex Stephanie, if they want to make this angle seem legit and work the marks, Nexus should change Cena's in-ring gear to anything other than the jorts. Maybe something similar to what the Nexus wears and something more ridiculous. What do you think of that idea?
You could change up what he's wearing. I personally liked the fact that they didn't have him come out on the first night wearing a Nexus shirt and changing up all his gear and stuff. I think if you were to make the full heel turn, you could go with that visual, because I think people really want to see him wearing that.
Do you think they're going to go with the full heel turn?
I know they're talking about it. I get the impression that ratings over the next couple of months are going to dictate if they do something really, really drastic with him, because it's a big risk turning him heel. I mean, that guy is selling merchandise hand over fist for the WWE, and it's if you turn on that audience, that's a huge revenue stream for them that they're going to be, you know, have to find replacement for. No one's selling merchandise to his level.
I don't think they would do that to the audience, though. I mean, look at how some of these kids were reacting to the heel turn. They're not going to crush these kids' hopes without giving them a good, you know, pay.
Well, that's the key. You got to have somebody ready to take over that top babyface spot. I don't know if Randy Orton's that guy.
Yeah, I don't think they're going to turn Cena.
Next up is Andy Gordon. Hey, guys, I would like you to review the 2001 No Mercy event since it was part of the invasion angle. Your review of Bad Blood 97 was okay, but it was the night that Brian Pillman died. So, yeah.
Yeah. Brian Hillhouse just watched the end of the Cena Barrett match from Hell in a Cell, and holy shit, the reaction of all the little kiddies was great. Reminds me of my disbelief sitting in the 500 level of the Sky Dome in WrestleMania 6 when the Ultimate Warrior pinned Hulk Hogan. I wish I could go back to those Mark Wrestling fan days that those kids are obviously in right now. I see why the WWE has gone PG and is catering more to the younger audience. Thanks to things like the internet, it's so hard to please older wrestling fans, so why try anymore?
Right. Thulani Mabuza. They should have just let Taker and Kane go over. They should have just let Taker go over Kane at Hell in a Cell. Not because I'm a fan, but the thought of these tired feuds continuing makes me ill. The Paul Bearer heel turn is just a retread of the Boiler Room match spot. In fact, everything about this feud is a rehash of a 13-year-old feud, and that wasn't even cool back when it was cool. I personally, I don't care if it's a rehash of an angle that was successful and people are reacting to it, but this has just been a flat feud to me. That's two pay-per-view shows in a row where it's been very disappointing, and the Hell in a Cell, I hated that finish. The match was very, very disappointing, and I just, it's an angle and it's a storyline that is not connecting with people.
Michael Howard, hey guys, the Brian Pillman Raw interview with his wife made me very uncomfortable. I was driving in my car listening, and I considered throwing myself from a moving vehicle for a second. McMahon's questions were so disturbing that it depleted my common sense and made me think irrationally about how not to hear this horrible interview anymore. The worst for me was, have you thought about how you are going to raise your kids? I just wanted to yell, maybe you should pay for everything, you insensitive little hamster. I have always thought Vince was fairly horrible, yet I watch his product. I guess that is a microcosm of every wrestling fan's relationship with the entire industry.
Chris in LA. Hey, I heard the review of Bad Blood of 97, and it was very good. I'm glad that you guys noticed the subtle differences in the Godwins. It should also be noted that their music changed from hoedown music to harmonica music that sounded much like the score to the movie Deliverance. Oh, and thanks for bringing up Spicoli's death in WCW and Larry Zbyszko. I remember when Schiavone announced Spicoli, and right after it, Zbyszko says, he's still a chump. I had it recorded and must have rewound it 1,000 times to make sure I heard it right. I also want to mention that they did this work shoot Goldust and Marlena interview weeks later where Marlena described her time with Pillman as wonderful, and Goldust breaks up with her right on the spot. Way to use a guy's death to further a storyline. At the very least, it should have been dropped completely. Way, I love you, man, but you are overselling the hell out of David Otunga's bad acting. Granted, he is not going to be winning any Oscars or even daytime Emmys for that matter. The guy does have some personality. I only saw a couple of episodes of that god-awful reality show, I Love New York, that Otunga was on, but was actually one of the more appealing personalities on the show. Granted, the scripted stuff he is forced to say might make him weaker, he is not as shitty as you say. Let's just forget about the fact that Otunga is married to Oscar winner Jennifer Hudson. The man has a degree from Harvard fucking law. It only makes sense for him to want to dethrone Wade Barrett. I think it's a testament to how awful the commentators are that this fact is rarely ever mentioned. I remember back when D'Lo Brown was wrestling in WWE, JR would always make mention of the fact that D'Lo was a certified public accountant.
He might be great for a reality show, but I don't think he's the right type of delivery, the right type of actor, if you can even call him that, to play this Nexus.
His delivery to me is horrible. I just don't get into any of his promos. They're all just there. It's a very bland delivery, and I don't know. He has not stood out to me at all.
Gunnar Wuhair. See, he gives us a few suggestions for what we should review. One is Lucha Libre USA. The entire series is only a few episodes long, and it wasn't half bad, apparently. Have you heard of this? Lucha Libre USA.
Oh, yeah, yeah. They aired a few on, it was like MTV2, and it's just disappeared. They were supposed to be on for a year.
Two, WSX. I never got to watch the whole thing, and I would love to hear you guys review it.
I actually did watch that when it was on, like 2007. It was on MTV, Wrestling Society X.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and three, Wrestlelicious. I'm not surprised no one has suggested this. This is, well, it's a show, women's wrestling, done by the same guys that produce WOW. Watcher beware.
Well, Wrestlelicious is actually currently on the Fight Network.
That's right. So we can watch it, and we can discuss it.
Maybe. Let's keep going here to Travers Cummings. Another awesome show, guys. I think if they do season 3 of Jersey Shore, they should just have Jose on as one of the main characters. Maybe get rid of Sammy and Ronnie. Doesn't seem to be much going on there anymore. Jose would fit in well since he pretty much already lives in the house and is friends with all the guys. Do either of you watch Family Guy? How about reviewing that show after the show is over? I used to be big in the Family Guy, and I got tired of it, and I stopped watching it. And it's also Sunday nights. I could PVR it, but I choose not to.
No, I don't watch the show. Aram Nasrallah, hey guys, thanks for the review of Bad Blood 97. I want to ask you guys some questions. Have you heard about the drug incident from the tapings of the Jersey Shore? I guess it makes sense since they can party and stay up like that without any problems. The only situation going on is up his nostrils.
Ooh.
Two, question. John, of all the wrestlers you have met in your life, who has been the worst and best in terms of just being kind and respectful? And then, Wei, how did you feel when you saw WWE portray Asians like Kenzo Suzuki, Orient Express, Yokozuna on TV?
First of all, the drug incident on Jersey Shore, didn't hear a specific incident, just that a situation was he was partying pretty hard on this past season.
Okay. Not that I care.
No.
There's no drug testing policy on that show.
Yeah. I don't know if he'd pass with flying colors.
Probably affect their performances, though.
Yeah. In terms of the best and worst dealings I've had with performers, Kane always jumps out at me as one of the best because I interviewed him a few years back, and it was after the interview that I realized my batteries had died about 2 minutes into the interview, and the guy was more than willing to come back and redo the interview with me. And I tried to change up the questions a bit for his own enjoyment, and he was just real cool about it. And he was on a media schedule. He had to be at a number of places. So the fact he did that for me, I always thought was really, really cool.
Was the interview better the first time or second time?
I don't know, Wei. It wasn't an hour and a half, though, so that was good. In terms of the worst, I guess Kamala we talked about at the Fan Expo earlier this year.
Yeah, although that wasn't really an interview. He just flat out didn't want
to talk. They're just saying experiences with guys. I mean, he was just did not want to be there and didn't want us. It wasn't even to talk to us. He just didn't want you even shooting like B-roll in his direction. Like, that was just like, dude, you're a public figure here at a public event, and we're media covering it. So
what am I getting out of what am I getting out of shooting Kamala? Like, the guy's dressed. I can't even. Never mind. I mean, I shouldn't criticize. If he doesn't want to be on camera, he shouldn't. But I guess I find it odd that you're dressed up here in your gear with your face paint, and you don't want people to take look at you. Yeah. You don't want people to take photos.
How about the Asian stereotypes, Wei?
I don't really get offended at the gimmicks themselves. I mean, I suppose like Kenzo Suzuki. Well, I think what I'm offended about is just how lazy the writing is. I mean, some of this old school stuff, like the Orient Express and Yokozuna, they all kind of came at a time when you know, cartoon gimmicks were the norm, I suppose.
The characters had one layer to them.
Yeah, yeah. I don't get offended. I think I'm just offended if anything, by lazy writing and lazy character creation.
Was Yokozuna really that offensive? I mean, he played like a sumo wrestler. No. Wasn't even Japanese, but I just thought they presented him as this kind of killer heel.
Yeah, I think Aram just means anytime I see like a like an Asian wrestler portrayed as a stereotypical one level Asian stereotype, do I get offended? No, not really. It's just pro wrestling. They're all stereotypes.
Yeah. Mark Cardoso, just watched some classic WWF Championship wrestling on YouTube from 83 and 85. Wrestling was so much simpler and got their points across, especially the angle they did with the Masked Superstar and Eddie Gilbert match. I was full-time into pro wrestling starting in 1985, so I missed some of the earlier gems like this, especially seeing Lou Albano manage Iron Mike Sharp in an interview segment.
Richard Lee, hey guys, good job on the Mad Blood pay-per-view. On a show that I remember watching on video, and I usually watch it all the way through, but all I did was watch the Nation of Domination match. Saw the midgets and fast-forwarded to the Hell in a Cell, even skipping over Brett and Owen. The only time I did that to a video of a pay-per-view. Best line of the review was Wade telling us what to do after athletic activity. Great hygiene advice. And then he goes on to say, for a title for the primetime review, which we just began this past Thursday, here are a couple of titles, such as Cheap Perusal of Primetime or Cheap Pop, or Primetime Passages. Anyway, love the responses to my write-in votes, and wow, John, a 96 Nissan, have to see a photo of that baby blue badass. Can't be worse than my 2000 Jimmy.
We're going with Review of Brock, everybody.
Review of Brock.
Which is currently up on the Facebook page. You can also download it from liveaudiowrestling.com in the radio player on the right-hand side. Or if you subscribe to us on iTunes, it's also up there. Justin Foe, just watched the primetime show for Brock Lesnar and Cain Velasquez. Interested to hear your review. This one will be a challenge because it was done so well. More of a challenge for you guys to poke fun at it.
And it was a challenge. I thought it would be a challenge, but then we just ended up having a really enjoyable discussion about, fight building and television production and MMA model versus the pro wrestling model. Yeah.
And we don't watch stuff just to poke fun at it. I mean, we're just kind of watching it, analyzing it, and chatting about it. And, I mean, some stuff is going to be terrible and other stuff is going to be good. But we don't just go out of our way to tear shit apart and laugh at it. It's primetime's the perfect example. It's not like we can make fun of a guy doing deadlifts.
Yeah, well,
or
yeah.
We could maybe. I don't know.
Anyway,
next one is
Jack Pisco. To weigh in, John, your Bad Blood review was great. Despite the circumstances surrounding this pay per view, you were both able to make this an amusing podcast as always. I remember watching this long ago, and I can honestly say I didn't see any problem with the constant reminders of Brian's death in the Raw interview with his widow. I was too young and naive to understand how completely tasteless this was. I can only hope that the WWE can handle these situations with more tact in the future, but I fear that's too ambitious.
That's always nice if you're young enough that that's what you do for deaths. This is accepted.
I just, I wonder about the next generation of wrestling fans that are, the Cena fans of today coming up and then maybe 10 years down the line reanalyzing any of the TV that's out there right now.
That video that person posted of those two, eight-year-olds.
Oh, fantastic.
That scared the shit out of me.
Those two wrestlers or the kid reacting to the Nexus?
Just the fact that these little kids are doing moves like that and stuff.
Yeah. They were doing a good job, though.
They worked a hell of a match for eight years old.
They were selling.
That one kid
well.
Was selling tremendously. I thought it was a decently worked match, but nonetheless, kids, don't kill yourselves.
Yeah.
Next up is we'll just finish off with this last one. It comes from Brandon in Finger, and he wrote into us, dude, love
Finger?
In Finger. INFINGER.
That's his name?
That's what he sent it to me as.
Brandon in Finger. Is that a
dude,
joke?
Dude, love the show. That's his Facebook name.
Okay.
Dude, love the show. I listen all the time at work. Wanted to share a great story for you to possibly share on the podcast. Against our better judgment, a few buddies and I went to the TNA house show last Sunday in Charleston, South Carolina. We pull into the parking lot, and this badass white Camaro is wanting to get over from the median. Smoking bitch in the passenger seat and a North Carolina license plate. So I let them over and say to my buddy, dude, I bet that's Flair. Well, we get to the parking attendant that is taking the parking money from everyone, and there seems to be an altercation. Suddenly, Ric Flair springs from out of the car and is yelling at the lady, "Your fucking curb bent my rim. What are you going to do about it?" She says back to him, "Sir, you were trying to exit out of an entrance. It's not my problem." To which he replies, "The hell it ain't your problem. I'm finding a cop." Full out nature boy, veins popping, sweat dripping, in real life for the enjoyment of just me and my crew. She replies, "If you're going to park in my lot, you're going to play by my rules. If you want a cop, there's one right down there." We are fucking dying by this point. It's just too awesome for words. Nature's just screaming back and forth with her pointing at his rim and getting put in his place by a 60-year-old parking attendant lady. He got in his car, floored it around the parking lot a few times, we were following him, and finally just parked his shit at the curb right in front of the field and left. And left it there. The show was at a local minor league soccer field. I should have recorded it, but I was in awe. My buddy took a few pictures that I'll send to you later in the week for verification. Take care and thanks for the constant entertainment on the podcast. By far my favorite every week. And by the way, you guys have to start reviewing Impact. It's a must. So there, a great nature boy story.
Great story.
Maybe we can expect photos.
I'd love to see those photos, especially of his damaged rim.
Could totally believe that incident occurring. So, everyone, that's the second time we've reviewed Bound for Glory and read your feedback. Thanks, as always. You can go to reviewaway.com, reviewaway.com, or just search for the group on the Facebook, which was its original name. Just type in Live Audio Wrestling's Review Away Facebook group. Sorry, that was a reference to The Social Network, which you haven't seen yet, right?
No.
Go see it. It's a great movie.
What do you mean, original name?
It was originally called The Facebook.
The Facebook, okay.
And then on the... what's his name? Sean Parker from Napster. He suggested dropping the.
Brilliant.
Brilliant move. So we always take into account your suggestions for future reviews. We do a number of shows every week, everybody, in addition to The Law that you can hear every Sunday night. Review Away follows it when you download it. And then Tuesday afternoons, it's Review a Raw. And for the next couple of weeks, we will have Review a Brock on Thursday afternoons, chatting about primetime heading into UFC 121. If you're not an MMA fan, don't worry. We do try and include the wrestling fans and kind of explain what's going on. And it's just chatting about the buildup of a fight, which, you know, when you build it, break it down. It's, you know, wrestling. It's the same tools.
We are wrestling fans. You're not going to get, like, a Sherdog Radio Network podcast. Like, John and I are wrestling fans. And we're, no matter what we talk about, we're going to talk about it from a pro wrestling fan's perspective. And this will be no different.
So, for next week, Way, the talk is that we're going to get Kane and Undertaker in a Buried Alive match coming up at Bragging Rights. As of right now, we don't know if that's 100% confirmed or not, but... Nonetheless, I thought we'd go back to October of 96 for the very first Buried Alive match at an In Your House event entitled Buried Alive between The Undertaker and our guest from earlier tonight on The Law, Mick Foley, as Mankind. And it's only a two-hour pay-per-view way, so a little less viewing for us this coming week. And we'll get out of here, though, with a song of your choosing, providing this all recorded.
Providing this is all recorded. If it's not recorded, then...
I'll cry.
Yeah, you will hear the screams of a John Pollock to close off the show. But if you do have it, I would like to hear Jushin Thunder Liger's theme song, the same song that my own ears have heard Samoa Joe sing.
Wow, that's an awesome choice.
Yeah, why did you do that? What was that?
I was just sounding excited. Excited about Jushin Thunder Liger's theme song. Ending our show here.
Alright. Are you not supposed to sound excited?
I'm always excited. Goodbye, everybody. Yeah.
から呼び